Hello, everybody. Well, today should be hopefully a very interesting video for you. You see, a few weeks ago, I was approached by World of Warships, and they were asking, well, we're doing this whole hunt for the Bismarck expansion because, well, it's the 85th anniversary of Bismarck being sunk as of the time of this video going up. And they asked me if I could do something about Bismarck using some of the in-game assets from their new expansion. And initially, I thought to myself, what could I do about Bismarck? I've already done Operation Rheinabung. That's pretty much the entirety of Bismarck's lifespan, and I think I did a pretty decent job of it. But then I came to a rather interesting realization. I think there is something else I could talk about when it comes to Bismarck that would be quite different and, I think, unique. So that's what we're going to do today. You see, I've been lucky enough recently to be working with Magellan, an underwater exploration and salvage company, and a few months ago they sent an ROV down to the wreck of Bismarck, and they filmed it in glorious 4K resolution, and they got a whole load of information, both in terms of bits of the wreck that had been explored just in higher res, and also they went out into the debris field and found other bits of the ship which previously either haven't been detected or haven't been videoed. And I've been working with Mike Brady from Oceanliner Designs and historian Joe Lavender over on their channel, that is Magellan's channel, going over in detail a whole bunch of the wreck footage. And since I'm therefore allowed to use the footage, I thought, well, why don't we combine these two things? So today we're going to go over some of the damage that Bismarck took in her final voyage and mostly in her final battle. And I'm going to show you where that took place, and then I'm going to show you what that now looks like on the wreck itself. Some teaser images, obviously, just here. So let's start off with Bismarck's first engagement. We'll look at a little bit of damage she sustained there, and then move on to her final stand. So this is Bismarck shortly before she leaves for her final voyage in what's called the Baltic camouflage. A lot of photos you'll have seen of Bismarck will show her in this particular camouflage scheme. And indeed, one of two new versions of Bismarck, which are now in the game with the update, Bismarck 41, as you can see here, comes with a rather fetching rendition of this camouflage. However, this camouflage was largely painted out during the voyage, and so she ends the voyage in a completely different paint scheme. However, because that paint scheme was applied somewhat hurriedly, and then they went out to sea before the paint had really dried, a lot of it has come off in the intervening 85 years, so the wreck actually shows significant elements of this Baltic camo scheme still on the ship. Of course, at the Battle of Denmark Strait, Bismarck famously destroys Hood, but she's also engaged by HMS Prince of Wales. And something that people sometimes forget is Prince of Wales, of the three capital ships present, is actually the first one to score hits. She ends up scoring three hits on Bismarck. Unfortunately, two of them are no longer visible on the wreck. One, because it hit one of the ship's boats, which was then turned to splinters and kindling by subsequent events. Another went very deep below the belt and actually ended up flooding out some of the boiler spaces. Unfortunately for us again, the lower hull below the waterline generally on Bismarck is A, under the mud, and B, has probably been crushed flat and or possibly even ripped off of the ship, so it's not visible to an ROV. However, there was a third hit, and that was to the bow, and this famously cut off access to a whole ton of fuel in the bow, which, amongst various other bits and pieces of damage, compelled Bismarck to try and return home, as well as, well, as you can see here from this photo taken from Prince Eugen immediately after Denmark Strait, caused a great deal of flooding, which, that's not a good thing. Pitching the bow down quite heavily and forcing Bismarck to reduce speed, partly to try and slow down the flooding and partly to give the damage control crews at least some chance of shoring up the internal bulkheads that are now subject to an awful lot of pressure. And we know roughly where this hit occurred, so if we go down on the port side of Bismarck's bow, as we come along to approximately the right area, well, there's lots of shell holes all over Bismarck for understandable reasons from her final stand, but this one stands out in particular. It's in almost precisely the area we'd be expecting. It's a little bit ragged. It shows definite signs of being an entry hole. And when you scale it against other known dimensions of various objects nearby, it works out that it is, in fact, just a fraction over 14 inches. So this is almost certainly the entry hole for the 14-inch shell that Prince of Wales flung at Bismarck. And yes, that is a little remnant of the false bow wave just below that white patch. Now, you might be thinking, well, hang on a minute, how does a hole that high up on the ship cause the flooding that we saw in the historical photo? That doesn't make much sense. And, well, you'd be right, except for the fact, of course, this shell went straight through the ship and out the other side on a downwards trajectory. And we know it couldn't have been an underwater hit because the accounts of the hit describe a through and through and not a massive explosion right next to the ship, which would have happened with an underwater hit. But we also have another easy way of testing the veracity of that particular claim, which is, well, let's go to the starboard side of Bismarck's bow, which is a little bit more buried in the mud than the port side. But nonetheless, as we come around to basically the exact same point on the opposite side, we see there are two rather large holes in the hull. Now, the upper one, which is almost a mirror image of the entry hole on the far side, that we can disregard because that is an entry hole from some other hit during her final battle. But below, you'll notice just above the mud, there is a rather interesting rent. And not only is it no longer circular, which would suggest the object is tumbling, but you can also see that the hull plating, as it's been split apart, has been pushed outwards, indicating that this is an impact that's occurred internal to the ship. So it's a projectile that's inside the vessel, which is then exiting the vessel. And when you calculate the width of the bow at this point and the relative height difference between the entry wound we see on the far side and this exit wound, the angle of fall that you get as a result basically perfectly matches the angle of fall of the shell that Prince of Wales would have fired at the range she fired when she actually hit Bismarck. So it's almost certain that these are the entry and exit wounds preserved on Bismarck down on the wreck. And as you can see, the exit wound is just a little bit further forward on the false bow wave line. And this would have caused a lot of flooding because, of course, the bow wave is painted at basically the height of a natural bow wave. Otherwise, it wouldn't work very well as a deception. And this would mean that water would very easily come flooding in here. Once it floods into the bow of the ship, of course, that weighs the bow down, which brings the bow lower, as we saw in the photo from Prince Eugen. And once that happens, well, then you are in a whole load of trouble because, of course, not only are you going to get even more water, not just the bow wave, but actually just general seawater coming in, you're also going to end up in a situation where the water pressure itself is increasing, and therefore the bulkheads below are under more and more stress. You can see here, as we continue down the side of the bow, a little bit more of it is visible. And we can tell that we've, at this point, basically got the entire above water portion of the bow showing, because you see this line that's appearing in the middle of the screen below the upper and lower plating. Well, if we switch over to a historic photo of Bismarck's starboard bow, you can see there's that exact same line as the armour plate starts to come in. And in this slightly blurrier photo, where she's in the Baltic camouflage, you can see the false bow wave there. And again, you can see that line where the armour starts to come in. So we know that this is basically the above water section of the ship's bow. She's almost exactly at her waterline in the mud. And in case you're wondering, but what about the bit under the waterline? Maybe there is a hit there. Maybe the reports that the crew gave about it being a complete through and through with no explosion on the starboard side were wrong. Well, unlike most of the rest of the underwater portion of Bismarck, we actually have the bow underwater section. It's just been ripped off from the rest of the ship and is lying on its side. You can see just here. And the extra fun part is, you can actually tell from the way that it narrows, if you didn't want to do any scaling, which of course you can also do, exactly how much of the underwater section of the bow is here. You can see it narrows to an extremely narrow point here at the top where it's been ripped off. And if we go to this picture of her on launch, well, you can see that there's the above water bit all in a nice pale grey. We've seen that we're pretty much down to the waterline on that. And you can see that we've pretty much got most of the underwater section present here. Indeed, in fact, we can match one of the frames from the underwater bow section pretty much perfectly. And as you can see, we've basically got, obviously with the perspective slightly warped from the underwater view, but as you can see it fading out again, the actual front section of the bow maps up pretty much perfectly. So the only bit that's actually underwater is a very, very, very small section maybe only a couple of feet between what we've got above the mud line with the main wreck and what we've got below the waterline with this broken off fragment. And so we can say if the hit was lower down, and somehow all the survivors' accounts got it wrong, we would either see an exit wound in this section, if the entry wound was in that very small section that's below the mudline, but it's not here on this piece, or the exit wound would be in the tiny strip that's been lost, but then the entry wound would still be above the waterline on the main wreck, and we don't see one right down there at the visible portion. So we can say pretty confidently that we've identified the entry and exit wound for Prince of Wales's hit at Denmark Strait. And if you want to spend your time looking at some of the damage of the ship in the game, well, they've got this thing, the Eisener Chancellor, I think, which means Iron Chancellor, which is basically Bismarck, but with a new 3D model showing some of the damage she sustained during her final battle. And so we move on to Bismarck's final stand. Now, of course, there aren't any close-up photos of Bismarck during her final stand because, well, as you can see, the British were a little bit far away. They were at point-blank range as far as naval gunfire was concerned. That's still a very long way away for a camera without a massive zoom lens. And, the crew of Bismarck had better things to do than take photos of their ship being demolished all around them. But from the various survivors' accounts, historians have been able to put together a reasonable degree of a timeline describing at least most of the major damage. So we're going to look at some of that now. Firstly, the conning tower hit. This fairly famous hit actually killed both the admiral and the captain of Bismarck very early on in her final stand, cutting her command and control functions down to just poor old First Officer Earls, who was elsewhere. There's also a fairly good indication that either shrapnel blast or both from the hit continued on backwards into the main bridge superstructure and severed the cables to the primary rangefinder station, which was further up and slightly aft of the conning tower. And as you can see here, this damage is represented on the Eisener Chancellor model. And as we head over to the wreck itself, we're just approaching the conning tower here. You can see it is a complete mess. Well, there's a socking great hole in the front of this section of the superstructure, which I can't imagine helps things very much. But as we go a bit higher, you can see there's a little divot taken out of the screen here at the top. There's a much larger divot taken out of the screen on the right, but more on that latter bit later. But if you follow the trajectory of the little divot, you'll see there's a massive splash and blast scatter all over the front of the conning tower. Now, this is obviously front and just ever so slightly to starboard. Now, exactly who scores the hit that puts an end to everybody inside this conning tower is a matter of some, shall we say, friendly discussion amongst various historians. Traditionally, the hit has been attributed to Rodney near the beginning of the engagement, but arguments have also been made for King George V and for one of the heavy cruisers. But, you know, regardless of who did it, I personally still come down on the side of at least one of the battleships, given the thickness of the armour and the effect of the general blast radius. It was still a very, very devastating hit. And of course, as you can see, the conning tower is not exactly short of a few other hits having taken place in and around it as well. Now, as we come round over here to the right, you'll begin to see there's a rather obvious, rather major chasm, which has essentially carved off the forward portion of the superstructure away from the conning tower, again represented in the in-game model. And this is another shell hit. This is definitely a battleship shell hit, and you can just see the difference between the armoured structure of the conning tower and the relatively light structure surrounding it, and the way it's just been absolutely torn apart. There's twisted and bent metal everywhere, and again, you can see on the right-hand side of your screen all these little rust spots that look like someone scattered a paintbrush. Well, follow the lines down, and you end up back at where the shell has carved this trench, and that is shrapnel and blast that's spalling off of the hit as it goes through. So bits of probably the actual superstructure itself being thrown up and scattered a bit like birdshot. And then moving along a little bit, this is coming down the port side of the conning tower, and you can see where there used to be a door. I say used to be because, well, that door has just been ripped clean off by another shell hit. And just on the bottom left there, just slightly rising out of view or dropping out of view, is another shell hole in the screen. And as we come around, you'll see, you can probably just about see hints of it now, there's another great trench, not quite as significant as the one up forward, but that has been carved through the deck structure just in front of the door. And again, you can see just to the left-hand side of the door, there's clearly been another shell hit, which has caused a blast pattern to form on the outside of the conning tower. And then coming up to look at the top of the conning tower, you'll notice there is what looks like a little ring mounting on the back. And this is actually a very interesting little bit of information shown to us by the wreck. You can actually also see the difference in photos. Now, whether or not this rangefinder was torn off by a shell hit and thrown somewhere, or whether it fell off during the ship's descent, obviously is impossible to prove specifically, but you can also tell from some of the other damage around here, there has been some rather violent disassembly on the conning tower roof in any case. So what is this exactly? Well, it's actually a very handy way of quickly dating photos of Bismarck if they happen to have the right viewing angle and a good enough resolution. Because as you can see here, this is a shot of Bismarck early March 1941, so only a couple of months before Rheinabung. And you can see there is nothing on top of the conning tower. In fact, there are some rather close-up shots taken at the same time from the superstructure, which actually show there's just a flat circular plate, no raised structure like we saw on the wreck. But if we go to another photo taken in Kiel not that long after the first one that we just saw, now you can see sitting atop the conning tower is a rather jaunty box-like structure with what looks like two cylinders sticking out either side. And of course, this is a little rangefinder, part of the overall fire control system. And this is what was on there. And you can actually see between the box-like structure of the rangefinder tower itself and the conning tower, there is a little ring, and that is the ring that is left on the wreck now. And just as a handy reference, this is the Eisner-Kanzler model. You can see there's the trench just in front of the conning tower, the ripped-off rangefinder, and various other bits of blast damage. But obviously there were plenty of other hits to Bismarck, so let's have a look at another one. Or to be more accurate, another series of ones. So we're back at the Eisner-Kanzler model, and as you can see, this is the port side forward secondary battery consisting of a pair of 150mm twin mounts and a couple of the 105mm anti-aircraft mounts. Now, most people who are familiar with the loss of Bismarck will be able to tell you how the main battery was knocked out, and we will be looking at that later. However, the secondary battery wasn't exactly spared either. So let's go and look at this area, but now underwater. So here's what the first of those turrets looks like now. So this is the foremost portside 150mm twin turret. Yeah, it's not in the best of conditions, is it? Basically, the entire back half of this turret is gone. And the reason for that can be seen on the surviving panel that's sticking out the back there. You can see there's a shell hole almost dead center in that plate. And once that shell is punched in, and that plate, if you scale it, that's actually a pretty big shell. When it's exploded, either the force of the explosion itself, or quite possibly the force of explosion plus other ammunition that was in that turret, has blown out and blown up the entire back half of the turret, leaving it pointed almost aft with the guns depressed and the angle quite high. Now, this obviously isn't the angle the guns were shooting at when it was destroyed, because, well, this would be a range far beyond that at which the British battleships were engaging at this point. So this is almost certainly a case of the explosion also destroying the hydraulic system. And the guns, in this case, being slightly weighted back, have run up to almost maximum elevation. On some other gun turrets, when this kind of hydraulic failure happens, the guns will run down. It just depends on exactly where the point of balance is relative to where they rest in the gun mountings themselves. And then coming slightly further back to the first 105mm mount, this is actually quite an interesting one in that there are two hits to look at. The first one is perhaps a little bit more obvious as we come past it initially. So this is a hit that's come in from the port side of the gun, although given where it is on the ship itself, this is a hit that's come in from, roughly speaking, the 7 or 8 o'clock position. It's a relatively small shell, probably a secondary battery shell. But as you can see, it's carved a neat little hole straight through the port side 105mm gun. And if you look very carefully as the sub or mini sub comes in, you'll also see there's a tiny little divot on the starboard gun. So this shell has just obviously disabled the mounting, but carved straight through this first barrel, not quite severed it. And having expended almost all its energy, just put a little dent in the other one, although the energy you need to put just a little dent in the starboard barrel would have rendered that inoperable as well. And if you look carefully on the starboard gun shield, you can see a few little splatter fragments from the shell as it would have exploded. However, this gun mount was not just disabled by that hit. As you can see here, the entire port side of the actual gun shield and a portion of the mounting has also been destroyed, torn away by an incoming heavyweight shell, and you can trace the path of destruction, as you can see, through the initial mounting, past the gun as a whole, and then into the deck and superstructure area just aft of it, where the shell has continued on into the superstructure and presumably exploded somewhere inside there. And then we come to the second 150mm mounting. And here you can actually see both types of failure in its hydraulics, one where the gun has come up to near maximum elevation, but also another where the gun has actually dropped down to minimum elevation, suggesting perhaps that whatever knocked out this turret had perhaps unseated the left-hand or port side gun as well. And unlike the forward one, you see most of the back section, including in this particular gun's case, its rangefinders, are still attached. But as for what destroyed it, well, from the outside, you'd think it looks okay, but if you look carefully at the top in the roof, you can see once again an incoming shell has left evidence of its successful penetration of the turret roof armor, and it has then detonated inside the turret, completely wrecking it and probably destroying the crew in there as well. And that's left it frozen in position, as you can see, basically facing almost dead forward. So this was probably an earlier hit in the overall battle as compared to the hit that totaled the first 150mm mount, which, assuming, of course, that these are frozen in place when the ship sinks, had some opportunity to turn around before it was destroyed. Of course, these turrets are, luckily enough, still attached to the ship, so we have to make some assumptions about their relative position, and most of the time it's supposed that these were the actual positions that they were in when the ship was hit, and therefore gives us some idea of when they were knocked out. It is theoretically possible that with the capsizing they may have shifted around a little bit, but we don't know that. And then finally, in this portion of the secondary battery, which is what we're going to be looking at today in terms of the secondary guns, there's the second 105mm mount, and I don't think much needs to be said about that because, as you can see, it's taken a heavy hit at some point and just been turned into a complete and utter mangled wreck. That's when the heavy shell explodes on the mount as opposed to bypassing it. But of course, there's the main armament as well, and all four turrets were knocked out at various stages of proceedings, perhaps the most spectacular of which being Bruno turret. You can see the reverse side on the Kanzler model here, but according to accounts from both survivors of Bismarck and the crew of Rodney, who fired the shot in question, they saw a 16-inch shell penetrate the forward face of the turret and explode, and or possibly cause other things to explode within the turret, which blew the back out of the turret completely, sending the entire armoured backplate spinning off into the sea. Now, there is some evidence of the absolute punishment that Bruno turret took in the form of the barbette, which is still on the wreck. As you can see here, there's a clear shot that's penetrated clean through the barbette armour, just below the level of where the turret would have been at the time. And this is on the initially engaged port side of Bismarck, so this is probably Rodney's handiwork. But at times, some people have disputed the sheer level of violence that disassembled Bruno turret and questioned whether or not the accounts of the back being blown out completely were really accurate, because the force of explosion that would have been needed to do that Well, it exceeds most reasonable estimates for the destructive power of a 16-inch shell on its own and would require some assistance, possibly from shells and charges that were in the process of being moved into the turret at the time that it got hit, possibly even ones that were stored in the turret, because there were storage bins in Bismarck's turret for additional ammunition. And of course, when the initial expeditions went down to look at the wreck, well, there was just a barbette there because all the turrets fell out when the ship rolled over, and so it remained a little bit up in the air. However, as you can see in this view, this is Bruno turret. Or at least what's left of it. Of course, having fallen out of the ship while the ship was upside down, all of the turrets seem to have then continued their way to the seabed while remaining upside down. So this is actually the underside of the turret. So those of you with various plans of Bismarck's turret in extreme detail may now want to flip the screen 180 degrees to work out what exactly it is you're looking at in terms of all these mechanisms. Because with some of the turrets, not Bruno in this case, but some of them, the entire shell hoist assembly also is preserved attached to the turrets. In Bruno's case, although obviously the view into the turret shows that that was either ripped out or has collapsed down and lower into the ship, it clearly didn't stay attached to the rest of the turret on its way down, because this is just the section that would have been sitting a little bit inside the barbette, and the main body of the turret, the gun house itself, and the guns are actually most likely buried in the mud that you can see surrounding it. Very, very possibly it collapsed on impact and was ripped off and this slid down, but that's less likely in this particular case than the fact it just punched a crater, which has then subsequently been filled in. In any case, how does this help us work out what happened to the back of Bruno turret? Well, you might have seen this a little bit off in the distance because the ROV was previously on the other side. Apologies for the flashing, by the way, but they were, of course, taking photos as well as video. But this is the overhang, the underside of the overhang of Bruno turret. And as you saw previously, the turret itself is lying near enough horizontal, basically flat. These plates, however, are not. They are lying on what looks like a little bit of a ski jump, but of course they are upside down. And as you can see, they're also sort of petaled out from each other. And right at the back there, you can see one that's actually been blown almost 90 degrees at the time downwards, although now it's pointing almost 90 degrees up because, of course, as we said, it is upside down. And this gives us a very solid bit of evidence that both what the survivors of Bismarck said and what the crew of Rodney said was in no way, shape or form exaggerated, because this is not post-battle damage. This is not damage that has occurred when the turret has hit the seabed. This is how it was shaped when it hit the seabed. And what it shows, obviously, is some colossal explosion, which has obviously not only destroyed the turret and the backplate is missing, shockingly enough, exactly as the survivors said. But as you can also see, it just completely bent down this aft portion of the turret quite violently and quite quickly. More so, as you can see, on our left, which is the turret's right or starboard side, which also gives us a clue of perhaps the exact alignment of at least the explosion, possibly also the shell, because, as again, as you can see as we pan round, the plating on what would have been the port side, left-hand side of the turret is somewhat less bent, and the bending gets progressively more and more violent as we head to our left, but what would have been the starboard side of the turret. So you can imagine, with the floor blown out from underneath it, there's no way the backplate of the turret was staying on. And so this level of damage pretty much perfectly matches, as we said, both the survivors of Bismarck and the crew of Rodney's accounts of the back end of the turret just being completely blown apart and the backplate being blown off over the starboard side and into the sea. But of course, while that hit by Prince of Wales that we saw at the beginning was the cause for Bismarck turning for home, it wasn't the cause, strictly speaking, of her final stand. If she'd been able to keep up the speed and control level that she had after the Battle of Denmark Strait, she probably would have made it to a port in occupied France. However, of course, she was attacked by Swordfish from HMS Ark Royal, who famously scored, amongst other things, a torpedo hit on her stern. And this jammed her rudders and meant that she was left with very minimal control, reduced speed even more so than before, and so she ended up being brought to bay by the Royal Navy. But is there anything that we can see on the wreck that shows us what happened there? Well, as it turns out, yes, there is. So in the final bit of battle damage we're going to look at today, we're going to go all the way to the aft end of the ship. Now, this is, of course, the starboard propeller, or at least the bit of it that is still above the mudline. And you'll notice that I said the starboard propeller, not one of the starboard propellers, because, of course, Bismarck was a three-shaft design, and so she had one port, one starboard, and one central propeller. And now, speaking of the central propeller, you might just about be able to see it in the background there, but let's spin around a little bit. So we're still coming in from the starboard side, but we'll gradually be getting more and more onto the center line, which is kind of defined by where those cables are. And just to the right of that, you can see what's left of the central prop. And in this case, that is a fairly accurate description because, well, you can see there's a big chunk missing from it and it is bent over as well. And the eagle-eyed amongst you might also be able to spot that relative to the starboard propeller, it's also not really in line with the ship anymore. And you'll be able to verify that in a minute. But this is rather important because what it tells us is that the torpedo explosion that crippled Bismarck's steering either directly hit the port side rudder or hit very close to it. In either case, what seems to have happened is that the explosion was powerful enough, and this is why we reckon it's probably localized enough, to bend the port side rudder both inward and forward to the point it came into contact with the central prop. And the central prop, of course, being a big spinning bronze thing, has gone chunk, 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 chewed up the rudder, probably helped in taking it off. But the rudder, being made of steel, has also taken a good chunk out of the propeller, hence the damage to the poor old prop here. And this would have rendered the central propeller pretty much unusable from this point forward as in terms of propulsion, because, well, its profile is completely distorted, the propeller shaft is probably bent, and trying to actually rotate it with it in such poor condition wouldn't have generated much in the way of useful thrust anyway, even assuming that it would actually turn and not just horribly grind and open up the various glands, etc., and cause a whole bunch of flooding. Now, you might have noticed that the rudder is not present, the port side one, nor is the starboard one. Not necessarily that surprising, given how much force would have been exerted on the hull in this area and the relatively speaking flimsy nature of the rudder attachments almost certainly being torn clean off, assuming the port side rudder didn't go that way immediately after the torpedo explosion. But as we pan over to starboard, you actually get some idea of exactly what poor shape the central prop is in compared to the starboard prop, which you can see is here now looking at it from the same camera perspective. This is what the prop should look like as compared to what it actually looks like. Although, interestingly enough, what we can also tell from the face of the prop as we leave it now is there's quite a lot of cavitation marking indicating that there were some issues with the propulsion and propeller design on Bismarck, because that is not the kind of scarring that you want to see on a propeller after the ship's been in service for a relatively speaking short period of time. And there was another function of the explosion from that torpedo, and that was that it weakened the stern structure quite badly. One of the disadvantages of a central shaft propeller design is that the overhang of the stern is relatively speaking somewhat thin and therefore somewhat weak compared to a two or four prop design where you can bring down the stern more in line with the keel, which gives it a bit more strength. But nonetheless, a relatively common problem with German three-shaft designs, especially in World War II, was this weak stern meant if they took a hit in that area, the stern could collapse or fall off. And as you can see here, this is actually what's happened to Bismarck at some point during her sinking. The stern has fallen off. She didn't have a transom stern. There should be more stern here, but it has just broken off relatively cleanly, and this is all that's left. Where the rest of the stern's gone, who knows? The debris field has not been fully video surveyed yet, but maybe it's out there somewhere. But you can see this is where the break occurred. And that wraps up our look at the various bits of battle damage of Bismarck, both as it occurred at the time, how it looks in the game, and how it looks underwater these days. Hope you've enjoyed that, and thanks obviously once more to Magellan for letting me use this footage. Link to their channels in the description below. And of course, thanks to World of Warships for letting me access all the in-game assets that have been used for that side of this video. So if you want to go and play World of Warships, if you are a returning player, there will be a bunch of Hunt for the Bismarck event containers for you. And if you are a new player, perhaps you haven't played the game before and you want to now download it and give it a go, then, well, you can use the link in the video description and in the pinned comment. And then when you sign up for the game, you will immediately get 20 days of premium account, a port slot for an additional ship, the Japanese Tier 3 Cruiser Tenryu, and a commander with 6 skill points to distribute. And then you'll get also a set of additional rewards as time goes on, which will amount to 7 super containers, 40 billion credits, 1 million elite commander XP, 600,000 free XP, 100 economic bonuses, which will allow you to earn more credits and more experience as you go, and the US Tier 7 cruiser Boise, which has quite a history of her own, especially when, ironically enough, it comes to magazine explosions. And for those of you who are currently playing World of Warships, of course, there's the Wishing Wharf and the various other elements associated with the current event, where you can pick up the various camos, items, and the new ships commemorating the 85th anniversary of the Hunt for Bismarck. And of course, any and all players can pick up the various bits of new content, including by using the Wishing Wharf, which is part of the event. So you've got the Tier 8 King George V class Prince of Wales, kind of stealthy as far as a battleship can be, close-range brawler, fitted out exactly as Prince of Wales was at the time of her engagement at Denmark Strait. Bismarck 41, obviously in pristine condition, also a Tier 8 battleship. Slightly different capabilities to the main tech tree Bismarck, including the ability to manually control your secondary batteries, and of course you can equip her optionally with the Baltic camouflage that Bismarck started Operation Rheinabung with. And the Eisner Kanzler, which I've mentioned earlier in the video, which is essentially Bismarck 41, but with a significant 3D model rework to show some of the damage that's occurred to the ship during her last stand. A new German commander, Ernest Lindemann, which kind of complements the already existing Luchins, who is already in the game, although unfortunately you can't put them both on the same ship, but he's there to, available with some special skills. And a number of specialist camouflages, which you can pick up and apply to various ships, all in different snazzy colours, if you want to make your ship stand out. So thank you for listening.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.